Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Alison Gray. Alison Gray is an award-winning writer based in New York City. You can read more of her work at www.alisongray.com. That's alisengrey.com. So first off, thank you for all of your great writing and for all of your work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
And thank you for having me.
So what I would like to talk about today is to start from an article you wrote and then just move out from there. And the article was, you've heard of rape culture, but have you heard of pedophile culture? So what is pedophile culture?
So pedophile culture is a term I coined to describe the cultural phenomenon of sexualizing the infantilization of adult women. So a lot of people use the term pedophile culture to describe the normalization of pedophilia in general, but that's not all of what I was getting at. I think pedophile culture is a two-edged sword. So on the one side, you have the sexualization of babies and little girls. On the other side, you have the sexualizing of adolescent and infantile qualities in adult women. So it's important to note that this phenomenon has those two major components, because if the only problem was the sexualization of little girls, there would be a way out. You would grow up and it would be over, but that's not true. And on the other side of things, if this was strictly a matter of only women being infantilized and sexualized, then little girls would be safe from predators, but that's not true either. So we need to remember that pedophile culture operates in two ways at once. One, making women into girls, and two, making girls into women, with the ultimate goal being making females compliant in male supremacy.
So what do you mean by infantilizing adult women? Does that mean talking in the baby voice that we hear? And what do you mean by that? How does that manifest in the culture?
Sure. Talking in baby voice to women can be part of it. I think there are a lot of examples I'm just not able to cover because so much of it is insidious and subtle. So, you know, talking to women like we're stupid and need everything explained to us may be a manifestation of seeing women as young and therefore less knowledgeable. But the things I covered in the article were things like cultural demands for women to have hairless legs and armpits and genitals, to have soft, smooth skin, no wrinkles allowed, to have minimal body fat and to be very thin, to have small labia and tight vaginas, and to generally be pure and virginal and hide our sexuality, which is a way of prolonging our perceived innocence throughout our lives. And one that I didn't mention in the article, an example of infantilizing women, is menstrual shaming. You know, women are expected to pretend we don't have periods, and they're met with such disgust and rage from men and even from other women in our culture. And that's one I wish I had mentioned in the article, but yeah, we could talk about that more here, I guess.
That, I don't, do you know anything? I don't. Do you know anything about the history of, for example, leg shaving? Do you know when that started? When that has, and same with, I guess, armpit hair.
Personally, I don't know it off the top of my head. I have read histories of it, and I'm not good with dates, so I can't tell you when that started. All I do know is that I read that shaving companies needed a way to market their product to even more customers, and so they manufactured this idealized woman who had hairless legs, and so women, like, overnight started buying razors, apparently, and believed that there was something wrong with having body hair, which just speaks to how powerful advertising is and how powerful media is, because I think a lot of women think that our quote-unquote preference for being hairless is an innate preference, that, you know, no one put that in our heads. We just genuinely like being smoother. And you'll hear a lot of women defend that, defend shaving by saying, well, it's my choice, it's my preference. And I think a lot of people don't want to admit how malleable we are and how impressionable we are. 'Cause I used to be one of those women who thought that being hairless was just a preference, that I like being smoother rather than hairier. But then once I stopped shaving, And I stopped exposing myself to so much media that, like, demanded that women be hairless. I found that I actually find body hair very comforting, like, to feel and to just be in, and that, you know, it never would have occurred to me that I could ever find comfort in body hair, which I think goes to show how powerful the influence of media is. It can even make you think that what you think is what you think.
When I think of body hair on women, which is frankly something I don't think of very often, I always think of, I used to teach at a university in the early 90s, and one of the things we would do during the last week of class is we would have sort of polls where people would ask questions like, how many hours a night do you sleep? Or how much do you really study every week? Or how often do you drink alcohol? Or just, they could ask whatever questions they wanted, with the caveat that nobody could judge anybody for it. And okay, one of the questions, because like all those things, you know, everybody says they're not sleeping at all in college, but is it really true? Anyway, so one of the questions that would get asked every quarter was, somebody would ask, basically, a woman would ask, so how many of you women shave your legs or don't? Or they would ask men. They would never ask men if they shave their legs, but they would ask men, so do you care in your sexual partners if they shave their legs? And I was always pretty stunned that almost all of the women would be completely disgusted at the notion of leg hair, and the men would too. And they would be completely surprised that when they would say, do you care in sexual partners if they have leg hair or not? I would say it's completely irrelevant. I mean, and what I would say is, you know, by the time I found out if they have leg hair, I've already made a decision. You know, it's like, I'm not attracted to them because of their leg hair. My point is that this was just, and everybody was just stunned that I didn't care. And it's, so my point is just how overwhelming approval there was for naked legged women. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? This was an opportunity to see how overwhelming the support or the how overwhelming the hatred of body hair is, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely. And I think it's, I also find it mystifying how aggressively angry people get about women's body hair, because, I mean, I think you could ask most women, at least in feminist or particularly radical feminist circles, about the first time we were made aware that there was something wrong with having body hair. And for me, it was when I was 11, and I don't know, I just had like some peach fuzz under my arm, and this was in Sunday school, a place where I guess I wouldn't expect to find this phenomenon, but whatever I did. I was in Sunday school and the teacher asked us a question. So I was really excited and I raised my hand to ask the question, to answer the question. And two of my peers in that class turned to me and very dramatically were like, ew, put your arm down. And I was so confused. I was like, why? And they were like, cause no one wants to see that. And I said, see what? And they were like, your hair, ew. And it was, that had never crossed my mind that there was anything wrong. I didn't even really notice it until other people pointed it out and had such a humiliating reaction to it. And then pretty much instantly after that, I was like begging my mom to let me shave. And I hadn't had that thought until it was introduced to me by, you know, social pressures. As an 11-year-old girl, I was already being pressured to be hairless, and it was, you know, I think a lot of women I've spoken to who have made the decision to stop shaving will tell you, we never hated our body hair until we were told we were supposed to.
So, what is the relationship between pedophilia culture and what is the relationship between pedophilia culture, the part we're talking about right now? I want to talk about things like Lolita in a little while and the sort of really mainstream pushing of pedophilia itself. But in terms of infantilizing women, that part of it. What is the relationship in your mind between pedophile culture and rape? I'm sorry, pornography culture.
Hold on, I have my notes in front of me. Let me just see if I wrote anything about that. Oh, yes. Okay, so, I'm going to talk about Gail Dines, just paraphrase a lot of what I've learned from her. She's a fantastic anti-porn activist, as I'm sure you know, but maybe some of your listeners don't know who she is. She has done incredible work in investigating our sexual desires and how the porn industry influences us. As much as we like to think that we're too smart and too self-aware to fall for any sort of propaganda or conditioning, we're absolutely not. All of us are impressionable to varying degrees. And unfortunately, a lot of what we are programmed to think and feel and desire happens on a subconscious level. So I think that's why we're able to tell ourselves, this is natural, this is just how things are, this is my choice, my completely independent choice, and it's just not. So to tie it into porn culture, there's a lot of debate about whether some child molesters are at the mercy of some biological compulsion or some addiction that they can't help, which you know, that can be debated, I guess. I don't really want to get into that. But what is known for sure is that some child molesters are not that way their entire lives. Some of them are made that way. So back to Gail Dines, she has interviewed convicted child rapists in prison, and she found that many of them do not consider themselves pedophiles, or did not for most of their lives, or even after being convicted, because they do still feel attracted to adult women, but they found themselves developing an attraction to girl children later in their lives, sometimes as late as their 40s, only after being accidentally exposed to child pornography, which, like, planted a seed in their minds, and the decision on their part to rape children sprouted from that. And she has also interviewed other convicted child rapists who say that their curiosity about raping children started when they started watching pseudo child porn, which is what she calls it when you have adult females acting out teacher-student scenarios, daddy-daughter scenarios, virgin manipulations, etc. So some child molesters can tell you that their desire to rape children never crossed their minds until they were exposed to actual child pornography or simulated child pornography. So people like to think, I mean, in particular, the men who watch these kinds of porn like to think that, you know, oh, it's just pretend. It would never, you know, I would never actually do this. And she's a consenting adult, this woman in the porn film. You know, I would never actually do this to an actual child. It's just pretend. And it's been shown that, no, that's not the case. And as a matter of fact, it appears, just based on Gail Dines' research, that there are more pedophiles in the making now as a direct result of exposure to child porn and pseudo-child porn than there ever have been in history. And this is uncharted territory. So, for whatever reason, the porn industry seems heavily invested in conditioning men to find girl children attractive.
Well, and in your article, you cite that the top Pornhub category is, quote, teen, end quote, or, quote, barely legal, end quote. And I have read that that is one of the top, or if not the top, pornography search is for teen girls. So that means that there are millions or tens of millions or however many men actively searching for that category.
Yeah, and not even just stumbling upon it, but looking for it.
And so let's shift for a second and talk about the mainstreamization of instead of talking about the infantilization of adult women for a moment, which we'll come back to, let's talk about the mainstreamization of adults sexually exploiting children and trying to make that norm, and how many forms of media are attempting to completely normalize that.
Mm-hmm.
So for when you, it seems that, I mean, not, it doesn't seem, you started your article by talking about an article in Salon. Was that the trigger for your article, or did you simply use that as the beginning?
I just used that as the beginning. As a matter of fact, pedophile culture, the way I describe it in the article, was an idea that I had been incubating for like 2 years before I wrote that. So I don't remember when I first noticed something was up, because in the feminist conversations I would have in college, you know, for whatever feminist means to a college liberal, we would talk about the sexualizing of children, but we wouldn't talk about the infantilizing of women, which I thought was really interesting because I thought they were just two sides of the same coin. And I started noticing that these weird things, like women's clothing, when I would go shopping, would have like bows on it, or like cute kittens, and like all these like cutesy things that, you know, there was no like equivalent for male clothing. Like there was no boy child interest being marketed to adult males. I'm not to the same degree anyway, or not in the same way. And that makeup would say stuff like look youthful or have baby soft skin. And I just started putting the dots together in my head that there was something up, you know, that there was maybe even an agenda here. I don't know on the part of any particular interest group or corporation other than male supremacy, but I started to notice it. And so when I read Todd Nickerson's article in Salon, I think that's when it struck me that I needed to say something. Because for this article of his to appear in such a well-respected mainstream publication, it just seemed like this was like the point of no return. I feel like once you can have a pro-pedophilia article run in a publication that's read by maybe dangerously open-minded readers, that this was, it had gone too far. And so I know it may have appeared that I was just responding to him, but it's so much more than him. You know, he's just one representative of many men like him, which is why I say in the article, I don't agree that he's, I mean, yeah, I agree that he's not a monster. He is actually a pretty common man.
Oh, let's back up for a second. And can you give like a 2 to 3 sentence summary of his article?
Oh, yeah.
For readers so that we'll know what we're talking about.
Sure. So Todd Nickerson is a self-admitted pedophile. He calls himself a virtuous pedophile, which means he claims that he has never touched a child in his life, that he's never acted on his desire to rape children. So he first, he says that he was abused as a child by, I think, a family friend, and that he believes that that may have influenced his what he calls a sexual orientation. And he said he first realized he was a pedophile when he had hit puberty already, but he wasn't interested in women the same way his peers were. And then he finally ultimately realized it when he found this young redheaded girl attractive, and he, you know, had to keep it a secret, and he didn't know who to talk to. And he paints this whole picture that he is just this victim at the mercy of his own desires, and sets it up to be very emotional. Like, he makes it, it's almost like he's trying to paint a picture of coming out, like to appropriate the struggles of gay and lesbian and bisexual people who have to hide who they are, and then they come out about it and they're persecuted. And it's classic of people like him, to play on the sympathies of people who are not like him so that he gets a free pass, I guess, to say whatever he wants, because, okay, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. Let me go back to the article. So in the article, he sets the stage to say, you know, I was abused as a kid, and then one day I realized I'm attracted to kids, and then I had to keep it a secret. And then one day I found this message board where there's a bunch of people like me, and I realized I'm not alone, and there's a lot of us who actually aren't monsters. We don't act on our desires, and I think people need to give us credit for that. And yeah, and then he finally ends the thing by asking people to sympathize with him and saying, you know, claiming that he wants to change or wants like some sort of help. But then, you know, in other pieces he's written or in things he's written on the Virtuous Pedophile forums, from reports that I've read of him, he talks out of two sides of his mouth. He, on one, in this article, he says he wants help and he, you know, he doesn't want to hurt children, but in other writings he'll say if it was legal, he would totally fuck children and, that, you know, children actually are able to consent and that they're agents and that they can, you know, they want to experiment and they should be allowed to. And so he's a trick. He's a real tricky guy. So I wasn't really responding to just him, but I was responding to him because he represents, you know, that manipulative pedophile that, you know, we all think of when we think of pedophiles.
And part of the problem too is that he is not alone. There has been, over the last decades, a movement toward mainstreaming pedophilia. Not just, once again, I want to come back to the infantilization of women, and I completely agree with you on the two sides of the same coin, but emphasizing the normalization of the sexual exploitation of children, I think, is there's been a strong push for that. We're increasingly seeing articles in that direction. There's an anarchist / queer theoretician who has said that children, if a child is old enough to decide whether he or she wants to wear shoes, they're old enough to decide whether they want to have sex. And this person means not playing doctor with another child, but this person also writes pornography where children are tied up and sexually tortured. So there's that movement. There's Lolita. There's a movie with I can't remember who was in it, but it was some major actors. Oh gosh, the guy was in French Connection. That's way before your time. Sorry.
Rock anyway. If it was modern, I still wouldn't know.
Gene Hackman. There was a movie with Gene Hackman several years ago where he gets arrested for being a pedophile, but the whole point of the film was for him to be able to deliver this extended soliloquy about how tortured he was, and he was the real victim and not the children that he was sexually exploiting, and how they, you know, brought youth into his life and how they were just so young and wonderful. And my point is that this is not... Nickerson is not one lone article written by one lone lunatic, but it's part of a larger push.
Absolutely, yeah. Actually, before Todd Nickerson, I forget what time, I think it was around the time of Obama's first election, because I remember there being a controversy about this guy commenting on Obama's young daughters, but I think his name is Lindsay Ashford. That was my first introduction to the pro-pedophilia lobby. You know, this guy, Lindsay Ashford, was running this website. I think this was his website where he would, like, list public events where there would be children, you know, for pedophiles to go there and just watch children. And he would, you know, he claimed freedom of speech and we're not touching them, we're just looking at them, we have the right to be in public spaces too, like, and there was so much, you know, controversy around it, but at the time, I think I was only 14 or something when I first discovered his writing. I thought, okay, you know, the internet is like just becoming a thing, and this is just like one of the consequences of the internet where you're gonna find out about all these like crazy people who exist out there in the world that you wouldn't have found before. And I kind of brushed it off thinking, okay, everyone just knows that he's crazy, right? Like, there's no way that anyone's taking him seriously. And then, unfortunately, that was a naive way to think because, as you said, he's, you know, these two men we're talking about are more than just two men. They represent an entire agenda, and I think it's very dangerous to think that they just represent themselves, because I think the assumption, like I made, that, oh, no one's taking them seriously, we can just brush them off, is exactly how they're able to become mainstream, because no one takes them seriously until they have a larger platform, and then it's too late.
And let's throw out some more examples of this in various media forms. There's, you know, Allen Ginsberg was a notorious pedophile and promoted it. Or a cover picture for your article is, and sorry for my lack of pop culture knowledge, but is that Miley Cyrus?
I don't think it is, actually. I just found it when Googling infantilization of women.
Well, so, but it's, the point is, it's a picture of an adult woman blowing a bubble.
Yeah.
And sort of made up to look like a child. So what are some other examples of either infantilizing, so let's talk about the media for a second, and mainstream media, which I think, I'm guessing, is something that both you and I are going to stumble over a little bit, but some mainstream media or fashion examples of either the promotion of pedophilia or the infantilization of adult women, either side of those coins.
Okay, so the first thing that came to mind is Miley Cyrus, because not long after my article came out, she happened to release a video called, I don't know if it was Baby Talk or something like that, and the lyrics were very suggestively, I don't know, I don't even remember the lyrics. I remember the chorus was, "Fuck me so you'll stop baby talking," and the entire video was her dressed up as a baby, like in diapers and in a bonnet with a pacifier and suggestively sucking on a milk bottle and crawling around, and generally just, there was a lot of emphasis on her sucking things, and it was very, very obviously meant to provoke disgust and I guess pedophilia in the viewers. And what was especially creepy to me was, I mean, I didn't like watching it at all, and I went to scroll into the comments, and in the comments, what a lot of the usually male commentators were saying was, "Did you see she had a nipple slip at such and such seconds?" And everyone was talking about her nipple slip in the comments, and it was insane to me that this grown woman could be simulating infancy, and even as she was simulating infancy, they're thinking sexual thoughts and they're aroused by it. I don't believe all of those men in the comments were pedophiles, but I do believe we've become so desensitized to this kind of pedophile culture that we don't see it as weird to be thinking sexual thoughts when someone's acting like a baby.
And wearing a diaper, for crying out loud.
Yeah, like explicitly acting like a baby, not even like acting like a kid, but a baby. And that's one example. And, you know, in general, a lot of pop stars who a lot of kids look up to are hypersexualized in their youth. Like, they start the industry very young. And they, you know, once they pass into adulthood, it's like as soon as they become adults, I'm talking like Disney stars and things like that, it's like they're not legitimate until they've done some sort of very sexualized song. I'm talking about people like Ariana Grande, Selena Gomez, maybe even Hilary Duff. I think she held out for a little longer before she started giving more sexualized performances. Lindsay Lohan, you know, they're all, Britney Spears, everyone thinks of Britney Spears immediately when you talk about this topic. So yeah, it's definitely there. I can't think of a single female artist, let alone one who started in her youth, who, was not hypersexualized in the spotlight. It's like you cannot be a woman in the spotlight who isn't, porn, basically.
So, one of the things you say in the article is that pedophilia is not nearly so taboo or shameful or repulsive to society as you claim it is. Mm-hmm. And I want to give a quote that I read by this feminist, Christine Grogan, which is, and she's talking about some other feminists. As these feminists pointed out, incest itself, and more broadly, the sexual exploitation of children by adults, is not the taboo, for it happens quite often. Talking about it is, by which she doesn't mean, you know, talking about it in the way that the commenters were talking about it, but talking about it in the way that you and I are. So I'm just saying that the taboo, I'm agreeing with you, that the taboo is not that that in, there's a sense in which incest or sexual exploitation of children is not taboo, since it happens a lot. What is taboo is saying, is talking in public and saying, this is happening a lot and it's terrible.
I completely agree. I think, you know, that goes for pedophilia and sexual abuse and sexual assault in general. I think people like to consider themselves against those things. But then, let me put this in a different way. A lot of the people who you know, wag their fingers at pedophiles, if it was their daughter being molested by their husband or their close male relative, suddenly they brush it under the rug. And so, exactly, it is talking about it that's taboo, and performing this disgust about it in the public view, but then in private, being completely okay with it.
So, it's kind of early to go this direction, but I just want to start as... There's more analysis of the pedophilia itself I want to address, but I also want to start moving us toward what we should do. But actually before that, you know, I know this is a weird topic to talk about on the radio, but something that, I mean, you talked about underarms, but something that was not a part of my generation, it's not a part of my world, and since I've not been a, I mean, I'm opposed to porn. I don't like porn. It's not really something that's been part of my world at all. But the notion of women shaving their pubic hair, can you talk about the relationship between that? I mean, this seems pretty obvious, but let's just be explicit on the relationship between that and the infantilization of women.
Absolutely. So that also seems to be heavily inspired by the porn industry, which, you know, they call it designer vaginas, the kinds of vaginas that, or vulvas, I should say, that you see in mainstream porn. So that's another thing. A lot of women claim that, you know, the ones who aren't aware that they've been conditioned to want to shave will say, you know, this is my choice and this is my preference, but I don't, in my heart of hearts, I don't believe that women enjoy taking a razor or hot wax near their genital area. I don't believe that's like some innate desire that women have. I think that's sadistic and self-torturing, you know, to accept that premise. And so, so the removal of pubic hair, you know, men who quote unquote prefer it will say that, you know, it makes it smell less bad and it's like, you know, it's more hygienic when women shave, so they should shave. And then the question becomes, okay, so then why don't you? Like, why don't men have the same pressures to remove their pubic hair that women do? And so their argument falls apart. This absolutely and clearly is about making women keeping them from growing up, basically. And actually, I want to lead into an entire like thing about neoteny. I don't want to derail too much from
No, great. Great. Please, go ahead.
All right. So after writing this article, I learned of a phenomenon called neoteny, which was basically pedophile culture, but from an evolutionary psychology standpoint. But, you know, evolutionary psychology will never, ever apply a radical lens to anything. It's all about affirming male supremacy. So neoteny is the phenomenon resulting from natural selection that leads a species to retain more adolescent and juvenile qualities into adulthood. So in humans, neoteny...
Wait. That, yeah. A legitimate example of that is some species of salamanders. Just, I mean, it does have a use in the real world, but then it's insane to put this on humans because humans are not actually salamanders. Anyway, go ahead.
I was actually going to list the ways that it's observed in humans, which is it's seen more often in women than in men, unsurprisingly. So neoteny, like some neotenic qualities in humans are higher pitched voices, a higher head to body ratio, lower bone density, a rounder face, hairlessness, larger eyes, a smaller nose, a smaller jaws, among other things. And all these qualities are more often seen in adult human females than in adult human males. And so there's been many a study to confirm that men are more attracted to women with more neotenic features. And women often don't experience that attraction to neoteny. In fact, women often are reasonably attracted to men in their age group, whereas men tend to be attracted to those youthful qualities all throughout their lives, no matter how old these men get. And so, you know, evolutionary psychology has all these ridiculous theories as to why that is. But, you know, a radical feminist analysis will tell you that this is consistent with male supremacy. And as a matter of fact, there was a cross-cultural study done by a man named Michael R. Cunningham that found that despite culture-specific beauty standards, in general, across cultures, men find women with highly neotenic features more attractive, and they find women with lower neoteny, meaning more adult-looking females, to be intimidating and therefore less attractive, which I think confirms what I was saying, that pedophile culture and this, like, normalization of being attracted to childlike features in women, it betrays on the part of men this insecurity around adult females, because I think I read somewhere that, you know, pedophiles by the clinical definition do report a high level of anxiety in interacting with adult females, that this is absolutely about insecurity. It's not about just some sexual orientation. It's about, I think it's about male supremacy.
Well, this actually brings up another thing. I wish I would have brought up a while ago when you mentioned Nickerson, but I forgot, which was that another part of the pedophilia, I believe, is that one of the ways that it gets propagated through time is that many of the people like Allen Ginsberg who are pro pedophilia will say, hey, some adult had sex with me when I was a kid, but it never did any harm to me. Look at me. They say as they're sexually attracted to children. It's like this, that there is this breakage that occurs or this wounding that occurs in these children that then is expressed later on. I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah. I do find it interesting. I read recently that despite the fact that there are actually many young boys who are sexually abused in childhood, that in regards to childhood sexual abuse, I think the proportion of boys versus girls who experience it is actually closer than in adulthood. Like, when you're a child, you're more or less equally vulnerable to sexual abuse, but as you grow older, it's more likely for women to be sexually assaulted than for men to be. But I was reading that even though there are many boys who experience child sexual abuse, it's far more often men who will go on to develop these, like, how do I phrase this? That a lot of rapists, and particularly serial rapists and pedophiles and child molesters who have been abused in childhood, like, there's a lot of them, but there aren't as many women who have been abused in childhood who go on to become child molesters. And so there is this sex discrepancy where, yeah, even though they both were wounded in childhood, for some reason women don't often go on to wound others.
Well, it seems to me that part of the reason for that would be that in this culture, there's a great line by Gail Dines that she condenses male and female socialization in patriarchy down to two phrases, which are men are socialized to say fuck you and women are socialized to say fuck me.
Yep, I love her.
So let's, we have about 8 or 9 minutes, and let's, before we do the what should we do thing, let's bring home, absolutely, I mean, you've mentioned this a few times, but just completely nail down the notion that this infantilization of women and the sexual abuse of children, they're both manifestations of males having to, of male supremacy. You've mentioned it. Can you completely close that off and help people who might not understand it?
Okay. I think the ultimate goal of pedophile culture is to make women subordinate. Because when you think about it, pedophile culture manufactures a version of women that look and act and perhaps even think like children. And if we perceive women as being more child than adult, we treat them accordingly. And how do we treat children? We treat them like they're stupid, like they're ours to control, like we dictate reality to them, and they're just supposed to accept it and stop asking questions. And if you're extra abusive, you treat children like rag dolls who can be tossed around and abused, and they're a target for your anger and insecurities. So if women are children and men are adults, and children are subject to the whims of adults, then women are subject to men. And children are not free agents. They are helpless, and they're dependent on us not to abuse our power over them. But in a male supremacist system, it is not value neutral for women to walk around looking and acting like girls, because male supremacists can't be trusted not to exploit that manufactured power imbalance. It's more than just symbolic to infantilize women to prevent them from displaying adult characteristics. It literally weakens us. It literally spiritually and physically weakens us and makes us easier to control by men. So on that note, I just want to say I'm not implying that women who do display adult characteristics aren't treated like shit by men, and I'm not saying that women who comply with the standards of pedophile culture are to blame for being treated accordingly, but I am saying that the men who benefit, whether consciously or subconsciously, from infantilizing women, which means all men, need to do some introspection and ask themselves why they have such a strong preference, quote-unquote, for women who are more like girls. And I think that begins the answer to the question of what do we do. So as for what we do, I think we really have to ask ourselves how much of our perception of women is informed, is patronizing. Like for instance, even our language betrays how much we patronize women. Like, in casual conversation, we refer to women as girls. And, we might say, oh, I was talking to this girl the other day, and what you mean is women. Whereas when you're talking about a man, you might not say, I was talking to this man the other day, but you might say, I was talking to this guy the other day. So you know we're not talking about a boy. So at least we still distinguish grown men from boys, but we don't seem to do that for women. And so I think we need to think about all the little insidious ways we patronize and infantilize women, whether it's the way we speak or the way we handle, the way we interact with women. And definitely campaign against pseudo-child porn. Absolutely. I mean, all kinds of porn, but it seems like in particular that's like the most immediately damaging. And yeah, there's so many approaches. I mean, a culture that rejects makeup for women would be ideal, because, you know, makeup definitely youthifies women and removes our wrinkles and, you know, erases our pores and basically makes us look like we never work or go outside, because, like, our faces are flawless. And so, there's so many approaches we could take, because it's such a complex web of phenomenon. You know, infantilizing women, it covers so much ground, from the clothes we wear to how we talk about women to how we talk to each other, that it would be impossible to give like a hard and fast solution. It would have to be multifaceted, the same way that we approach rape culture. That's definitely like a discussion I haven't really had yet with anybody, you know, how to stop it. We just know that there's a problem, but I would love to, you know, continue having that conversation or you know, read what other people have to say about it.
Well, despite what you just said there about you haven't, you know, had that conversation yet, I want you to, if you don't mind, talk about for a moment what men should do. Mm-hmm. You've talked about, you know, an anti-makeup campaign, or you've talked about, or the wearing of less makeup. You've talked about some things for it seems for women, and certainly men should not call women chicks, you know, all that
yeah.
stuff. But what else should men do?
Definitely give up porn. I think that's step number one. Even men who don't necessarily watch a lot of porn, or I should say young boys who don't watch a lot of porn themselves, are surrounded by boys that do. You know, as you know, the average age of exposure to porn is 8 years old now. It used to be, I think, 15, which is not necessarily better, but 8 years old. That means that's the average. That means like 4-year-olds are stumbling across hardcore porn on the smartphones that their parents give them. And so, you know, we absolutely can't deny that this is having a major effect on the sexuality of this generation in particular. So I think, you know, to give up porn and to encourage other guys to give up porn, if only there was as much public shaming of men who watch porn as there is of, like, you know, homosexual men. Like, I don't think homosexual men should be shamed, but it's amazing what men will shame and what they won't. I think it's a matter of, like, using the power of social approval and social rejection to give men an incentive not to watch porn anymore. And it really comes back to introspection, which you can't really trust oppressors to do, but there are a handful of men out there willing to do it, and they need to be the ones doing it aggressively, turning inward, asking themselves, why don't I like pubic hair on women? Why don't I like large labia on women? How can I undo this? Because I want to tie it back to the Gail Dines studying of men in jail for molesting children who feel like they were turned into pedophiles later in their lives. If we know that pedophiles can be made into pedophiles later in life, I think that implies that they can be turned back, that it can be unconditioned. And why not try? So I think since a lot of our sexual desires are fed to us by the culture around us, I think we can purge ourselves of those ideas, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of self-awareness, but I do believe it can be done and it should be done.
So that's all really wonderful, and you already talked about women, and I'm wondering if you can, for like a 1 minute close here, if you can give a rallying cry for women to throw off the chains of infantilization.
Oh man, wow. You know what? I'll have to just talk about this from a personal standpoint and hope to lead by example. I mean, I do have a high-pitched voice, and I've been working on that. But other than that, you know, I don't shave anymore. I avoid wearing makeup. I avoid wearing anything with, like, bows and kittens on it and anything cutesy. I don't wear high heels. That's really important, because not only do high heels make you wobble around like a toddler who doesn't know how to walk, but they literally injure your feet. Like, they do horrible things to your feet. I think the most important thing for women is to start acting like... You have to get to this point in your head where you just know who you are, and so the idea that you should ever modify yourself for anybody else is offensive. You have to get to the point where you're offended by the notion that anyone would ever want you to shave your pubic hair off. Like, who do you think you're talking to? You just have to train yourself and practice it, but one day you will get to that point where if you ever, like, read an article in a women's magazine that says, like, why you should get a bikini wax, you would just laugh or be like, are you kidding me? Like, trust me, you can get to that point, because I used to just eat that stuff up. I you know, most women don't see the need to resist that kind of propaganda. But once you do see the need to resist it, I think it'll naturally start developing from there, that you'll get back in touch with your sense of self if you just, like, put enough conscious effort towards it. So yeah, it's a matter of, like, knowing who you are and being utterly offended at the absurdity of anyone telling you should look like a little girl.
Well, thank you so much for that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Allison Gray. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.